What sweater shall I wear today? Which sweater shall I wear today? The blue one? The red one? The blue one? The red one?
Good morning now. The time, 7 a.m. You're tuned to KMUD Garberville, 91.1 FM. KMUE Eureka 88.1 FM, KLAI Laytonville 90.3 FM, we are K258 BQ Shelter Cove at 99.5 FM and on the World Wide Web at kmud.org. It's time for Monday Morning Magazine. You can tell by Buddy Guy in the background. It's Richard Ginger and Jeff Fadine.
Okay, well, we're here.
This yeah, Richard, I can hear you right through the tube.
And that's Jeff.
Jeff Fadine here.
And we got Chris Peters waiting in the wings here. We got a couple quick things to take care of before Chris Peters joins us. We have a really good show lined up today. Chris is going to be on after we get a few announcements done until 7:30. And then I'm hoping that Dan Jordy and Michelle Bushnell will be on between our custom hour 7:30 to 8:00. And then from 8 on, Chris Peters is going to be leading a discussion with a lot of different other guests, including Perry Lincoln, Michelle. and Jason Franklin and Nicole Whipple, we hope, and Vernon Wilson, Michelle Merrifield. Yes, so I'm not sure if Bruce is going to be calling us up with a quick summary about the options for diversions from the Eel into the Russian that will allow the removal of the dams to allow access to an incredible amount of high-quality steelhead and salmon habitat. And one thing just to mention, it's going to be coming up more, is the Headwaters deal, there was, anywhere from 6 to 11 so-called lesser cathedrals, and they're good for 25 more years, but something has to be done, and probably finding a place for them in this 30-30 arrangement for protection might be the way to go, but that needs to be addressed here in the coming futures. Okay, so Chris?
Let's see, we also...
go ahead, get your microphone.
Okay, so Bruce, if you're listening in, you can call in on the KMUD phone, the studio phone at 707-923-3911. I'm sorry I didn't send you that number earlier this morning.
Doesn't everybody have that memorized?
Okay. I do not know.
Yeah, I think there's three options. It was discussed on the KMUD News, and Bruce found a summary in a Press Democrat article from Santa Rosa.
So, actually, I've got the article. So for those of you who have been semi-following this was a startling announcement to me where they had a headlines on Friday's paper, Potter Valley Project Plans Advance. And inside, announcement that said, on Tuesday, the recently created Eel Russian Project Authority selected one of two alternative approaches to the new infrastructure. Members chose a pump station facility that would draw water from under the surface of the Eel River during still undetermined high wintertime flows. From there, it would be pumped to a higher elevation and sent through an existing diversion tunnel to the East Fork Russian River. And as I called around, none of the people that I knew who were really following this, trying never to miss a meeting, et cetera, were saying, I don't know about this. Russian Eel River Authority. Well, I asked who authorized it. They said, we don't know.
Authoritarianism just springs up. But it does involve removal of the dams. Chris, I've known Chris for quite a while. I first met Chris in, 77, I think, when the Sinkyonia Wilderness was getting underway and actually formally trying to protect it. And I needed advice. And Chris was at the Indian Legal Services on 3rd Street, I think. And he and Marilyn Miles were on the staff of that, and there was a whole no-go road. And Chris has been, since his beginnings, has been really absorbing and responding to all the needs of indigenous peoples, his particular ancestors, and broadly. And Chris will take you from there, and it's going to be an exciting day. Thank you, Chris. There you go.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Very well.
Okay,
very well.
Thank you. Hey, some background and a little bit of correction, maybe. In 77, I was working for Tri-County Indian Development Council. It was initially housed where CILS, California Indian Legal Services, ultimately ended up. I was on the board of California Indian Legal Services at the time. And correct, Marilyn Miles. Well, in 77, Abby Abinanti, who is a judge at the Yurok Tribe now and a judge in San Francisco, were initially involved with the Go Road case. And back then I was fairly young. You know, I was... the hope, if you will. Now I'm an old man, but I was the hope for the next generation. And, given that dictate, I took it to heart and led a major campaign, to save the Go Road. The Go Road, as you may recall, and I'm sure Richard does, but it involved a construction of a road through the high country or the prairie areas, if you will, of the Yurok and the Kudduk and the Tolowa people. And we couldn't allow that to happen. You know, the road would go through the heart of the sacred area. And gradually over the years, the road was built in increments, you know, from Gaskede in the west and Orleans in the east, and gradually it encroached upon the high country. We didn't have anything to stop it. There was no environmental impact report or anything like that over the entire process. There was just an environmental impact over certain areas where a road was going to be constructed. And we got down to the last 7 miles, unfortunately, where we could put up an argument to stop the Go Road. And we did. We organized community and we were involved in litigation at the district court level. And we won, you know, unfortunately, fortunately. And we also won at the appeals level, the Court of Appeals, and they appealed it to the Supreme Court, at which we finally got defeated. But, you know, the Go Road sets a precedent for sacred lands that are off reservation areas. And keep in mind, reservations were primarily set up for concentration camps for Indian people. We were placed on reservations, and it wasn't intended to be a cultural or religious spirituality exercise in the process. It was most of the places are off reservation areas, and unfortunately, it ended up on federal land. Some of it's on private land, but most of it is on federal land. Forest Service, BLM, Bureau of Land Management, and you know, the court system just couldn't allow us to exert a religious freedom on lands that they owned, or technically owned. But we contend that our sacred places are important to us, and that to fully exercise a religious First Amendment right, which everybody is guaranteed in the United States, that we have access and use of the areas. Well, the road would totally eliminate that access and that ability to use the sacred areas on an ongoing basis. And at that point, there was a lot of people still alive that were giants in terms of my involvement. You know, Jimmy James was a litigant. Sam Jones was a litigant. Walter Lehrer was a litigant. And Walter is still with us. And, you know, there are other people who are significant in my background, you know, including Frank Douglass, Dewey George, you know, a lot of people that are significant people. And at the time we were in litigation, we were also starting a jump dance. A jump dance is an earth healing ceremony, a 10-day ceremony in Pequon. And the high country was necessary for the continuation of that ceremony. We used that high country on an ongoing basis at that time. And, you know, the revitalization of who we are as people was important. And we certainly exercised our right to do that. And in many situations, the area that was considered sacred to us required a visual and an auditory uniqueness, quietness, and as far as you could see, an open area that was pristine to be able to exercise our religious freedom. The intent of the Forest Service was to log the area off for no intents and purposes, but just to cut down the trees and sell the trees. And we couldn't stand for that. Ultimately, the area was left in the final plan. A road was didn't want any stopping of the road, so the road was left in until there was some legislation, and legislation ultimately closed the road. We have now a road that goes nowhere, both sides, up to the 6 mile, 7 mile stretch. So that's the GO road, and it's a long history. My involvement in it was a lifetime commitment, still is a lifetime commitment, and we are certainly wanting to protect the area.
No GO road. And part of that, it seemed that, you know, the Supreme Court said you had religious freedom unless they decided you didn't whenever it came up. And one positive thing that came out of it was the protection of Blue Creek, and that there's a whole history of that, too, that could be covered. But it was an inspirational thing. Non-Indian people were inspired, Indian people were inspired, and it was adamant, you know, like there. It's like people were looking to that, and there was so much intertwined with that, with the whole fishing rights fight, the salmon wars, you know, from the state of Washington and further north, I imagine, down to California. It was thresholds were reached that were not to be gone past, and people are still dealing with those things today, and much appreciated, Chris.
Well, thank you. You know, I think the impacts of the GO Road is still being heard throughout the nation and throughout the world. You know, what happens in the United States happens throughout the world. But in the United States, folks that are struggling to fight the mining and roading and development and of Indian country as parasites are prohibited because of the GO Road. You know, so it laid down some very bad law, you know, and, you know, up until the Supreme Court, you know, they reversed what the trend was for generations and generations since time began. And that was the test that they were having, that an area had to be more important than public benefits, an overriding public interest. And they couldn't prove an overriding public benefit, so they went to saying that they can do whatever they want on their land. And unfortunately, the Forest Service considered the area their land. And ultimately, that made the decision. And closely following behind were several important cases that involved sacred sites off the reservation, and they lost. And it continues to this point of Oak Flat. You know, that decision that happened in Oak Flat. Oak Flat involves a huge mining area, copper mining, that's going to destroy a sacred place. And recently, the United States government approved the plan to continue with Oak Flat. Knowing quite well that the huge hole that they would use for mining would destroy a sacred place.
Where is that, Chris?
That's in Arizona.
Okay.
And it's a huge area, significant area for Native people.
Yeah.
And they've taken the issue to D.C. They've taken the issue all over. You know, the ultimate decision is within the court system.
Yeah, there's issues like that and close to that all over the place. And one of the ones, I don't know how much we'll hit on it today, was the situation in Jackson Demonstration State Forest. There's other things that are all tangled up in the pronouncements by Newsom and earlier Jerry Brown about heritage protection and land back and co-management, et cetera. So a lot of that would be come up today, I imagine, in the discussions.
Yeah, you know, I think the important thing is the United States government, state of California, and international, the UN, are turning to Native people for an answer to climate change. You know, the white population, the majority population, has got themselves in a fix with climate change, and they don't have an idea. They don't have a clue on how to get rid of it, how to get out of that situation. We may have a few answers to deal with climate change, but it takes a lifetime change. It takes a life behavior change, and people don't want to make that decision yet. But eventually, by force or by choice, they're going to have to do it. By force, things will get so bad that it'll force change. And by choice, people will have the intellectual ability, ability to make a change through their own reasoning before things get too bad. I'm hoping that there will be that decision being made, realizing that people are going to have to be forced into change.
And Chris, I find it interesting that you use the term their own reasoning. I've looked at that part of our behavior off and on over the years and come to the conclusion that it isn't a process of reasoning. It's a set of acquired assumptions that have been learned from the cradle to the grave by generation after generation. And this idea that, well, this is the way it's always been. This is the way it will always will be. Nothing has changed. I worry about that term we used to use was cultural momentum, that is so hard to deflect and to move away from.
And yes. Well, some of the program that we've outlined taking place at the 8 o'clock hour, we'll get into that a little more deeply. And I encourage people that are tuning in now to stay with it and be among the listening audience to see what's going on in Indian country and here in California, because it's an important thing that's happening here in California. We'll talk about those things.
I'm looking forward to it.
So maybe if there's certain specific experiences you had personally and with Seventh Generation Fund that you might want to share. It's amazing to me how Seventh Generation Fund reaches out to traditional indigenous people to help empower them. And that from watching from afar, seeing being manifested with Seminole in Florida and with Fred Coyote Downey Wailaki here.
Yes. And those were fantastic projects that we've had in the past. We raise money every year. Seventh Generation Fund is a small foundation. We raise money every year and we re-grant it out to grassroots and traditional communities throughout the world, primarily in the United States, because that's where the funding comes from. But it provides some hope, some optimism, that our traditions, our customs, our belief systems can survive in this world today. And I think that's important to have available is we don't give huge grants. 50,000 is the high grant that we provide to communities. But 5,000 gets them down the road, pays the bills, pays the light bills, pays transportation, gets them to a meeting where their issues are going to be talked about. And the small grants represent a significant amount of money to grassroots communities. And did for us at the Go Road. You know, we were a project first. Seventh Generation Fund is 47 years old. We're the oldest Native foundation in the world, and we're proud of that. I've been with the organization now for 34 years, and that's a long time. I initially said 5 years is the maximum I would be with any organization, but Seventh Generation Fund offers an opportunity to do to be an activist, and get paid for it. A small amount of money, but it gets us down the road a little bit. And we are grateful for that. Seventh Generation Fund, as it exists now, has been focused on community projects. All of the uranium mining, all of the what they used to call environmental justice programs, we were at the forefront of that, from uranium gold mining to, you can imagine, whatever else, timber harvesting, everything to stop that intrusion within Indian country. And we were successful in a lot of situations. A small amount of money goes a long ways in opposition to mega corporations. And we were able to pull organizations together that were confronted with the same mining operation. And they combined strategies and motivations to oppose it. We also supported a lot of language programs, a lot of art programs. And Native communities Native communities use a lot of different techniques, a lot of things to continue with the survival of communities. And we hope that'll continue in the future. Over the past 4 years, we've been able to allocate about $5 million a year toward grassroots and traditional communities. That is a drop in the bucket. We need to be able to to generate enough money to make a difference. That keeps people with the hope and optimism that they have, but they want more in terms of change, and we need to give them more. We need to generate more money from communities, and we have an adamant rule from the very beginning not to take government money. We don't take state money. We don't take federal money, and that's important because we believe that dollars has some strings on it, and I don't discourage other people who are needing to take federal and state money, but we don't. We are relatively clean, as clean as money can be. we're focusing on foundations and individual donors, much like people in the audience here. You know, $5 and $10 helps us down the road.
Yeah, that brings up it's a K-Mud pledge drive right now, folks. And K-Mud's bringing you this from Chris Peters and Seventh Generation, and we're going to be going on after the supervisors. And so go to the K-Mud website, or there's not an extra person here at the phones, but this is the time to make those small and larger donations to keep this going. K-Mud is, what, founded in 86 or something like that? You know, it's a growing, steady organization, and it needs everybody's help. You know, one thing, Chris, you might want to share, you just were at the Truth and Healing Council quarterly meeting, I think, something on that order, and maybe you have some things you'd like to share about what was going on at that Truth and Healing Council, and what do you see that's positive, and so that people can understand. That was what, Newsom got that to be formed?
Yeah, it the Truth and Healing Conference exists. We were actually at a land back program that was all of the people receiving land back were brought together, and you know, I think Seventh Generation Fund was both a funder of a lot of people in terms of bringing them together, and others that are a strategist in terms of how we can combine our thought process into to develop a land back strategy. You know, I think the first strategy that we need to look at is the issue of native trust lands, you know, and redefine it for ourselves. And it's not going to be a conservation effort, you know, and I think that needs to be put out of people's mind, that we're developing a land trust organization for a community that's going to be different. It's going to look different. It's going to act different. And I think it's important that we're given that latitude in terms of what we want to do with land back. And I think that took up a lot of discussion at the meeting too, is how do we define that? And unfortunately, it's up to the people that are involved in getting land back now, that's going to shape and decide on what a trust land arrangement is going to be. Taking it back into federal trust, tribal trust, takes a long time. And they have certain strings attached to what we can do with the land and how we can do it. But a native trust we need to explore.
Yeah, so the Winneman Wintu have been really, Sisk, the leader, Kayleen Sisk, you know, like they've really been working, you know, among other things, to get their Chinook salmon back from New Zealand. But there's a lot of negotiation and seeming progress. Of course, a lot of the papers about this co-management or land back arrangement, you know, has that if push comes to shove, the state trumps. But you might want to what you know about that and explain to people some if you do.
There's a major effort out with state and federal government. We've got some effort up here in terms of co-management, which is working fine. you know, we do a ceremony here. It's a jump dance ceremony, a contemporary jump dance, a Wela Wela Ga ceremony. It's a 10-day earth healing ceremony. And it starts, well, entirely on state and national park service. We've established an agreement, a co-management agreement, where existing property and materials used for the jump dance ceremony will be made available to Native peoples now and into the future. We have an agreement with them, and you know, we want to eventually raise that to a level where that is guaranteed to us in the future. So that's co-management. And co-management, in a lot of situations, is an opening the door. They don't believe Native peoples have the intelligence, the capacity to manage an area that has been theirs for eons of time, since the beginning of time. And the co-management is to assert state and federal or private or whomever into the process of management. But we look at it as a stepping stone. You know, first is co-management, and then ultimately complete management of it. Land trust or some process that we will develop.
A lot of boils down to, like I've seen in the last few years, is getting to the 50-50 part. That's a crux. Now, so we got the half hour here, and I'm not sure if Dan Jurdy is on. So Dan's not on yet. So do you need a break, Dennis? No, he doesn't need a break, so we can keep going on things you want to discuss, Chris, until Dan shows up, which he may or may not.
Okay, hey, that's good. You know, there's Jason is on, and there's a number on too that I'm not too sure who they belong to, but you know, there's people on as well. You know, I'm encouraged by the land back concept, you know, and I think Native peoples, we're not talking a small amount of land, you know, 150 acres, 200 acres, 300 acres, even 1,000 acres. We're talking about
3,000.
Huge amounts of land. Huge amounts of land that will ultimately come under Native control. And I think that's important. You know, and if we're looking at climate change, we need to have some drastic decision-making out there. And that drastic decision-making is Native control over natural resources, Native control over lands, and water. You know, water is going to be an issue in the future. And we need to make sure that we have adequate supplies of water to last us well into the future. And before the American society messes it up, you know, ultimately with we see at Standing Rock and a few other places that we've seen around the country where they're going to make some bad decisions and ultimately put into a jeopardy a significant amount of water. And, you know, I think we're facing that now. You know, I'm glad to see that dams are opening up on the Klamath. Dams will soon be opening up on the Eel River, which is great. You know, I think it's necessary that we begin to take land back in however we can, you know, buy it back if necessary, and keeping it available to us as we move forward.
It's really so, like, for instance, just looking at the eel. You know, like, what was it, 1910 or something like that? The people downriver in the Russian River have been benefiting by these huge amounts of water taken out of the eel, and the eel has suffered directly as people in the salmon fishery. And now they're talking about taking the dams out. But how are you going to make – because you have so many people. There's so many people and the huge increase in population that's out of – out of whack in terms of what the land will support. So all these modifications and all the thousands and thousands of people in the Sonoma and Marin and Mendocino is got sort of the short end of the stick. But what are you going to do? I joked being waggish about if they cut off the Eel River water, you're going to have human beings flopping around in the streets of Santa Rosa.
Yeah. Well, they can do it at half the wineries that they have they're irrigating now, you know, in Sonoma and Mendocino County. That Eel River is being siphoned off for a profit-making enterprise that is not ours. I think the eel has some potential, and you know, not only for the Wiyots, but for all of the Indian tribes that are impacted by the dams currently, and allowing fish to flow, allowing fish to run the way they used to run. That's what we're hoping for in the climate. This is finally removing of major dams, has the river back to its original course. And, you know, there's ultimately threats of the control that the dams may provide. But I think we live with it. We've lived with it for thousands and thousands of years, and we'll live with it again. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd like to see more of free-flowing rivers throughout the world. And we can only do that. The reality is that the amount of electricity being generated from the turbines put into the water system are minimal. And I'm not suggesting that we go to nuclear power or any other means of generating electricity, but we start to go without. We began to look at how we can begin to take our to remove the habit we have in terms of luxury living and get back to basics.
And how to do that is like because it requires a steep, deep cultural change of a subsistence and a whole reining in of the worldwide economy based on fossil fuels. It's out of control.
It's out of control, totally out of control.
And we have to include the ocean, the oceans, yes, of the planet in that riverine water system.
Definitely.
To continue to treat the oceans as the all-purpose dump has to end.
Oh, it's crazy. It's crazy. The amount of plastics that we find in the ocean now is just incredible. So, you know, I can stop at any time, and if you have other people that are coming on that need to have conversation, you can do that.
Dan Jordy hasn't come on yet, as far as we can tell. I'm trying to text him to remind him.
And we're having little problems.
Hi, Richard.
Oh, here he is. Right. I hear his voice.
So hang on board, everybody. Dan is here now. So, Dan, what's up?
Hey, Richard. I had to call in today. So Jeff and I were talking about the funding for the fire department, so I thought I would give an update. At tomorrow's Board of Supervisors meeting, we have a routine item. We're going to approve the this year's allocation of the funds that go to the fire department based on voter approval of a tax at private campgrounds. So back in 2020, voters approved in Mendocino County a campground tax. So private campgrounds in other parts of the state were already collecting a transient occupancy tax. And in Mendocino County, starting in 2021, created the same tax, only it's going specifically to the fire department. So in our county, that's equaling roughly $20,000 a year to each of the 20 fire departments. And that's based on a recommendation from the Fire District Association and the fire chiefs. So that's on consent for tomorrow. It's about $600,000 a year in the 3 years it's been in place. That was following up an item that 8 years ago, the Board of Supervisors mutually agreed with the fire departments to begin sharing a statewide sales tax that was approved way back in the Pete Wilson era, 1993, for public safety. But up until 8 years ago, that none of that money was shared by the county with the fire districts. It previously was all 100% going to the sheriff, DA, public defender, those county offices. So 8 years ago, the Board of Supervisors started sharing those funds, which is about $400,000 a year. So kind of added up, it's about $1 million a year between the two. And then just moving forward, 2022, voters of Mendocino County approved a quarter-cent sales tax, which is something in the neighborhood of $4.2 million a year for fire protection and fire prevention. 90% of that money is going to the fire departments, and 10% of the money is going for fire protection prevention, which is going to our Fire Safe Council. So they do things like they leverage those funds with other state funds they get, so they can sponsor chipper days in neighborhoods and all sorts of things. So so anyway, that Jeff and I wanted to talk a little bit about just the funding, the ongoing needs of fire protection and prevention in Mendocino County, and that is on the consent calendar for tomorrow.
And I'm sure that a couple of people from the Mendocino County Fire Chiefs Association, et cetera, will be listening in carefully. This is a very important issue, and as I have tried to say at meeting after meeting after meeting, this is no longer just a local issue. It is a California issue. It is a planetary issue. Everybody who is traveling throughout the state of California is going through all of these little volunteer fire departments, and almost all of these little volunteer fire departments are struggling to outfit an emergency response team. According to OSHA, state law, et cetera, standards for training and personal protective gear. It's a very expensive process for particularly the small districts with very little population within them, and by and large, absolutely no capacity to tax the region in which they live for actual financial support. And it, I have a great sense of sympathy to Chris Peters and all of the indigenous efforts to create a similar capacity to care for the people that they touch and the people who pass through without even being touched until they have a car failure issue that all too often is life-threatening and are depending on a group of volunteers to leave their tables, leave their work, leave their family needs and respond to a life-threatening situation. We really need to do better to the process of how we care for ourselves and our visitors, for the whole human community on Earth. And so,
well, yeah, Jeff, and as an example, the kind of the human side of that, a volunteer firefighter in Leggett was responding to, you know, just sort of an act of nature where lightning struck a redwood tree next to the post office in Leggett, and he was responding to the fire, and you know, significantly damaged his car.
There wasn't
money from the fire department. I mean, that was his personal vehicle, and so you know, there was a GoFundMe. So the community, you know, myself included, donated money to help him out a little bit. But I mean, that's kind of the human story of what happens when you have people, community members, volunteering in these fire departments. I mean, they take a toll on a personal level that you know, risk. Isn't the case when you have unlimited funding for, you know, a 100% fully funded fire department.
Yes. And we spend a lot of money on insurance, too. And most of the departments have an insurance policy that that covers the volunteers themselves and the basic equipment, but you hit that issue of the privately owned vehicle and POVs, we call it. And the POVs get used to get many of the response teams members to an incident. And I think we should add that with that Leggett incident, the Leggett post office is reduced, I mean, literally to a pile of charcoal and cinders. But we saved, Piercy, the Piercy volunteers were there as well as the Leggett volunteers. The mutual response systems in Mendocino County work quite well. And we still have a general store in Leggett
to the post
that
office.
Was almost shared a wall with the post office. You could certainly toss a tennis ball in between the two buildings. But if you hit any wind resistance at all and that tennis ball took a little curve, it was going to hit one building or the other. And I do think that as important as vehicles are to each of us, and, you know, we will one way or another get that volunteer with a set of personal wheels again that are adequate to needs. But the fact that enough people showed up there with enough training and enough gear that Leggett still has a general store right there, basically, where Highway 1 meets Highway 101. It's a place where a lot of people stop to ask which way to turn to get to here or there, et cetera, as they drive our highway systems to explore the state or just to get to a business appointment or to meet a distant friend or family member. You know, this whole system of getting people to where they want to go, to getting stuff to where people need stuff.
And to advise them, too. If they're asking how to get to Usall to meet their relatives, they better be aware that the road from Highway 1 to Usall, in its worst shape in 50 years, I have it on good account. And things are really can get out of control there in terms of safety and ruckus and having a good relationship with the land and the ocean and the beach there.
Yes. For those of you who don't know it, Usall Beach is part of the Usall Wilderness State Park, and it is a wonderful part of the planet. If you haven't been there sometime, you should stop at the Leggett store and ask for directions and take a look at this spot.
It's also next to Intertribal Sinkione Wilderness, and also 3,000 acres was purchased between Usall and Rockport by, say, the Redwoods League, and I understand their original intention, and I think it might be coming through, was to turn it over to an agency or the tribes, and it looks like they might be coming up with, you know, some kind of form of co-management. And so everybody pay attention to see what happens.
Yes.
You think Michelle's going to make it today?
I'm here.
Oh, good, 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 Michelle. So, Dan, thanks so much for getting on. And that was a good conversation with you and Jeff about the whole emergency services.
Okay. See you next month. All right. Bye.
Yep. See you then. Okay, Michelle.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes.
clue us into the county of Humboldt and what you're doing for us there.
Is this- well, yeah. So the big thing, so we do have a meeting tomorrow. We won't have a meeting next Tuesday following Easter Sunday. But, you know, we have a lot of items on our consent calendar. But our big one, one of the big ones is that Fleener Creek, which is up Navy Base Road out of Ferndale, has had a massive slide into the ocean. Massive. I don't even know how large, but it has taken out the parking lot area there and continues to break off and slide into the ocean and is very close to taking the road out.
Is that south of Centerville Beach?
Yes. Yep. Yeah. I if maybe y'all have seen some of the pictures that have been coming out of that area. But so the sheriff has declared a state of emergency, and we'll be talking about that tomorrow, and what the options are. You know, I don't know what the options are. We'll find out tomorrow. Supervisor Bone is the supervisor in that district. So it is surrounded by BLM and private landowners. So that would be the, I think what we would be discussing also is, you know, the workaround or an emergency road would, you know, encroach on personal private landowners and BLM, which would have to all happen with their approval. So that'll be coming tomorrow. And that area up there is very unstable. I know a lot of people have went out, you know, want to go out and look at it. And but there, it is very unstable. There are lots of pictures on social media. Brandon Rice, he has a drone business, and he has put a lot of pictures out of, you know, with drone footage that are just excellent pictures. So go on to, you know, his site or social media before you go out and stand on the edge, and you know, it's been crumpling a lot. So
drone industry is a growth industry, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good way to access areas that you can't physically access.
We could have a special hour-long special about drones, good and bad. How anyway, but it's incredible what drones can do to show what's going on.
I think that drones, just like what you said, can be used wrong. You know, it is kind of can really encroach on people's personal space. But also they are used a lot in emergency search and rescue these days, and can cover a lot of ground and very rugged ground where search and rescue can't get or can't get timely, mm-hmm. you know, when it's when they're looking for someone. So, yes, everything has an up and a down, right?
Good. It's a heck of a tool for terrestrial and aquatic information.
Right. So then also Human Resources is going to be bringing the Workplace 2030, formerly Great Workplace Culture Change. This is going to be a program update. This is a program that the county has been working on to make the workplace a better place for the county employees. There's been a committee for a couple of years that have been working on this. So there'll be a report by from Human Services on that tomorrow. And then we also have a couple public hearings. Public hearings are we as the board convene into a public hearing, take documentation from staff report, and then weigh in on an item. Most of the time it's like the two tomorrow are revocation of a conditional use permit, which is a cultivation permit out on Highway 36. And then the other one is a public hearing for purchase of real property located at 803 4th Street in Eureka. This is Public Works is also has facilities within their department. And so the county has been trying to create a county campus and buying up some land so that the county employees and county departments can all kind of be within one. So that's a very long term. And so this is part of that. And then the revocation of this commercial of this conditional use permit is we 2 weeks ago had two cannabis permits that were revoked. This is the first time this has happened since cultivation was legal at the Board of Supervisors level. So the only person that, or only way a cannabis can permit can get revocated is through the Board of Supervisors. And so those are starting to happen.
Amazing. One thing, I guess it's safe to congratulate you. There's going to be no further elections for your district office.
So thank you. It's not final yet. I believe it will be this Thursday, but there were only 832 votes left to count. And so there aren't enough votes out there for me to lose my seat. And so you're correct. There will not be a runoff.
There'll be no claims of rigged, huh?
No.
That's
no.
good. So the other thing is this Thursday between 10:30 and 12:30, is a meeting of the Redwood Trail, commission, at the supervisors' chambers between 10:30 and 12:30. And so you've been following that issue, and we're going to be talking about that more today, too.
Yeah, so I've went to most of the community meetings for the Great Redwood Trail. I'm also the Buckeye organization is having their annual meeting on April 6th. In Fortuna. They've asked me to speak a little bit on the Great Railroad Trail. And then Supervisor Madrone is the seat on that committee, and I'm the alternate on that committee. And so the portion of the Great Redwood Trail that encompasses my district is up the Ill River Canyon from Fortuna, out Carlotta, up through Alder Point and Island Mountain, and then goes into Trinity and Mendocino, which is Dos Rios area, a little bit on the into the Trinity side and a lot on the Mendocino side. And so the landowners in that canyon are concerned. And at this time, I haven't, gotten behind the trail. And I do think that there are good economic drivers that are associated with that trail in the right area. But I do want to make sure that, the landowners and the folks in my district are heard and compromises are made when it comes to that trail going through their property. These are large ranches and large tracts of that trail. And I do really think that in the right areas that the Great Road Trail is going to do great things for the counties that it encompasses, but I have not supported the trail at this time. Although I want to, and I just need to make sure that the landowners are addressed, and also the Wailaki Nation has come out and has issues with it, with the trail along in the Ill River Canyon that are their ancestral burial sites, and so they. They had some concerns there as well.
Yeah, and other tribes too. It's really something that they kicked off that whole trail thing without primary consultation from the beginning. But we'll get into that.
Yeah. So and then we have a lot of items on our consent calendar tomorrow. These items, like I've said in the past, are just business items that come every meeting, different, but every meeting there's a business item for many of the departments. And we still offer a hybrid motion or hybrid option for our meeting. So you can go on Zoom, listen to our meeting, and you can public comment. And then you can go on to Humboldt Legistar and look up our agenda. And then on each agenda item, there is a staff report. And if you click on that staff report, it'll tell you, 1 to 2 page synopsis of what the item is about and how it will affect the county, how it will affect the county budget, so forth and so on. So those are, I suggest to everybody that you do that once in a while, because those items do affect everybody in Humboldt County. And, if you have interests or inquiries, you should reach out to your supervisor. Also, supervisors, if they're these consent items, if there is concern from a supervisor, they can pull that item off for discussion and ask that department head to come to the meeting and do a little bit more explanation. That happens a lot of the time. And then the final thing I want to kind of mention is our clerk of the board, Kathy Hayes, who has been a 20 and a half year employee for the County of Humboldt, retired. Her last day was last Friday.